You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast. Be prepared to expand your mind and question your reality. As always, your host, Kevin Sullivan.
Makes things, you know, if I do Skype.
You sound great.
Okay, good. All right, perfect. Yeah, I just had to do some old-fashioned tweaking, which basically means move the phone closer to me.
Oof.
So yeah. Don't
hit me with this technical stuff.
That's right. So what I'm actually doing is the we're just talking on a plain old phone. And then I have your audio pumping through and my audio pumping through separately through a board, and then it's being recorded. So this is the way a one-man show works when I don't have a producer sitting in a sound booth or anything like that.
No, it sounds great. You do great things with that.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. All right. So my first question is going to be the hardest hitting question. Do you still have your beard?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a little short right now. It's a summer beard.
Okay. You might not think that's important, but see, the first thing I saw when I looked you up, obviously, was your glorious beard. And being another beard connoisseur myself, or grower of beards, I was disappointed when I read an article today. I was going through some stuff, and I read that you are now clean shaven. I said, "No way, that can't be."
I don't listen to everything you read.
So the what's that quote? Details of your beard's demise are greatly exaggerated. Is that how it goes?
Yes, that's right.
All right, perfect. Yeah,
no, it's coming back. Hey, yours is beautiful. No, mine is a very junior version now of what you have.
You had a great one going there though for a while. And what's actually interesting about this conversation, as we say this, I am actually right in front of me looking at no kidding, actual follicles of your hair in my own mini museum. Let's get started. So with me tonight is Hans Fex, and to be honest with you, Hans, when I read your name, I thought easily that this was going to be a European interview. I had no idea you are just a few miles away from me. Actually, you're up in Virginia, right?
Yes. Okay. Fairfax.
Okay. I'm down in outside of Raleigh. So to kind of get into it, you are the creator of the mini museum, and this thing was right up my alley. I don't remember how I found it, how I discovered it, but for the listeners, what the mini museum is, and obviously I'm going to let you talk about it a little bit more, but the quick rundown is it's maybe 5 inches by 4 inch piece of, is this pyrite or what is this?
It's a plastic, acrylic.
Okay, acrylic. And inside the acrylic is all different. This one has 33 specimens. So all different. Actually, to let you know how long ago I got this one is number 5217 of 5550.
Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, hey, no problem. You probably remember exactly this one, don't you?
You know, it's actually strange how much I can remember of different pieces.
I can
look at a lot of them and recognize certain things. I mean, it was a lot. It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And looking at each specimen very carefully. So actually, and that happens with a lot of people here who have helped me make those. They also remember them too.
So you kind of
some pieces here and there.
Kind of get into a Zen state and put these together.
Yeah, every single specimen in there was so carefully made. It's those eggshells from the dinosaur eggs there, from the sauropods.
Yeah.
I needed to make, of course, as you saw, thousands of these pieces. And I wanted a cross-section of each egg. So when you look at that dinosaur egg, you'll see, when you're looking at it, you see a cross-section, and you get the top, the outer shell, and the inner shell of that egg. Every single person has just that.
Wow.
So they get the whole kind of cross-section view. I don't remember if that's so well explained, but that's what's there.
Oh, okay.
And every cut was so intense because I knew I didn't have enough, and I had sourced as much of it as I could.
Okay.
And there was just, you know, when you're sourcing that much of something that's so rare, there's nothing left then, and it's and there's a deficit, and I needed to get even more of these pieces just last minute,
because
I was running out. And each cut was so important. Yeah. So it's like that with a lot of those pieces. Each piece is so important. We only had, I think it was like 11 pieces left.
Oh, wow.
Out of thousands. That's how nerve-wracking each cut was. It was horrific. Yeah, sorry, that was a long answer.
No, no, that's good. Because, I mean, you're chopping up something that's millions of years old. You want to take a lot of care
yes, with it. Yes, that's the other thing. You don't want to waste it. But not only that, there's just not... It's not enough to waste sometimes. Yeah. I mean, there are some more of these available on the market, but at the time, these were hard, very difficult to get. And actually now those eggshells can no longer be brought out from Patagonia. So it's illegal to bring them out now to export them any further. But this came from a very large collection.
Oh, wow.
And there's actually literally there, it seems extremely rare, but there are literally miles and miles of them, very far out there in Patagonia. It's a desolate, beautiful area, but it's out there, and there are, you know, I don't know how to say it, millions of these pieces left all over, strewn around these fields there.
Wow,
still.
Well, rare. let's before, because you and I obviously know what we're talking about, because I have one in front of me here.
No. Yeah,
so let's. I'm going to have you explain in your words what the Mini Museum is, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Oh man, I interrupted you, and you were doing such a good job.
I was so grateful
that you were doing it for me. Okay, it's the truth. I was thinking, oh yeah, you're going to be. I never explained it very well.
Okay.
It is. It's a 4x5, like you were saying, 5-inch tall. Piece of plastic that is made to be inspirational. So inside of that is a collection of specimens, little pieces from larger pieces of some of the most rare and inspirational things that we can gather and place into this piece of this little miniature monolith that then you can put on your desk and you can hold in your hand, and like some people have in their garden something, a rock in the garden, a large rock that kind of, it's an inspirational rock, an inspirational stone, or just to have anything on the desk.
Yeah.
Well, this is a different thing to have on one's desk or in one's hand to hold, to give one inspiration, to give one. Is that okay?
That's perfect. And what I love about it, I mean, I have a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old, and they will pick it up and bring it over. And my son's obsessed with the poop. He wants to, where's the dinosaur poop, Daddy? And I'm like, okay, it's right here. And he thinks that's hysterical. But I mean, even at that young age, they know that this is something interesting, and they know that these little pieces in there are more than just, you know, fragments of rock or little, you know, twigs or whatever. They know that there's each little, I guess, specimen is its own story. It almost has take the, what's one I'll just look at real quickly, the mammoth hair. So there's a little section of woolly mammoth hair, and you know, this isn't a representation of mammoth hair. This isn't a, you know, even a fossilized version of anything is kind of a representation of it. You know, it's been, it's been replaced by stone and minerals but this is actual hair. That was around over 10,000 years ago. I'm guessing around 12,000 years. Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Something like that. Yes.
That grew.
Probably a little bit older, but yes.
Okay. That grew, was living, you know, it was part of an animal that is so far disconnected from us that it's really, it's almost like fiction, right? You know, we read about it, but we don't, it's only something that's in the books and in your imagination. And now it's right there. You know, I'm holding it in my hand, a piece of animal that, you know, roamed the earth, that met a demise, quite quickly, actually. And, it's really awe inspiring.
Yes. And it, like you're saying, it's inspiring. It makes you want to read more about it and study it. And in studying it, you look it up online, then you see the latest kinds of results about it, which update your knowledge a little bit. And then serendipity happens, and you discover something you weren't ever thinking you'd discover. It's something totally different, something maybe not related to mammoth. And you keep studying, you keep looking, and you keep adventuring in your mind. And Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the pieces in here, or one of the specimens that I connect to the most, is my entire life I wanted to be an astronaut. Anyone who listens to the show knows I just wanted to be an astronaut. And I mean, as I'm talking to you now, I have 1969 Life magazine with Neil Armstrong on the cover. So, you know, it's something I always wanted to do. And I got close. I flew aircraft for the Air Force, but I never made it to NASA. But there's a piece in here of the foil of the lunar module. Is that right? Let me look here. The lunar module for Apollo 11, or no, the command module. I'm sorry, the command module foil for Apollo 11. So this is a piece of the spacecraft that put a man on the moon, and it's right here. You know, again, it's not something I can look up and, you know, read about or look at pictures of. It's actually right here for me to hold and to look at. And that's just amazing.
Yes. That one, that it's kind of, to me, it kind of represents, one of the most amazing things that we as little people on this planet have been able to get together and do. And
yeah.
And, it took a lot of teamwork and a lot of nationalities. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, really we were planning, Kennedy had planned that we would work together hand in hand in friendship with the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things with that space program that can teach a lot of people about, yeah, about a lot of good togetherness and also how much it takes to do something like that. I mean, we still haven't walked on the moon since people, other countries, and even the U.S. Since the first then a few years of walking the moon. Mm-hmm. That piece there came from Buzz Aldrin. So Neil Armstrong, kind of person who wouldn't sell anything. He was
are you saying,
I don't know, very low key about that kind of stuff.
And yeah,
he was, yeah. But Buzz Aldrin, he ended up selling that. His wife kind of pushed him to sell off some of his stuff. So that's directly from Buzz Aldrin then at an auction.
Oh, wow.
Did this piece come from? Yeah. It was waited a long time because I wanted, that's the other thing of each piece in the mini museums, how we get them. We want them from the best source possible. And there are some good sources to get the Apollo 11 foil from that came back down. It was on their capsule when it returned and landed in the ocean.
Okay.
And it was brought onto a aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was cleaned off, and this foil surrounding it, this gold on the outside, silver on the inside, it was peeled off of it.
Okay.
And then it was used in awards, or no, gifts, I should say, not awards, but gifts to people. They would put it in Lucite and give it as a gift to people saying thanks for, NASA would. And then Buzz Aldrin kept a whole bunch of it. I think Armstrong and Collins also kept a bunch of it. But Neil Armstrong sold, every now and then he sells still. Well, you know, he said he wouldn't sell anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I still think he sells about its square inch worth a year, and in maybe he cuts that in quarters and sells that in a kind of like auctions that are made to benefit other people and who need to be benefited.
It's an amazing thing to a person like myself. It's almost like having a piece of, I don't know, Columbus's boat, or, you know, I mean, it's monumental, you know, it's that important.
Yes.
Where, and for the listeners, what was your inspiration to do this mini museum?
Oh, well, yeah, I was in second grade, and my father, he had just returned home from a business trip, and I missed him very much. And I'd kept on hugging him and running around the house and doing different chores and then running back up to his room and giving him hugs and things like that. And this was one of the times I was running up there, and I ran to his room, and he shouted at me to get out. And I turned around right away and I ran out of the room. And as I'm running down the stairs, back to continue something else I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And he shouted over the foyer, apologizing for screaming at me, telling me to get out. He explained in Swedish that he's working with a neurotoxin. He's working with an epoxy, a two-part epoxy.
Oh, wow.
Where he's putting a little piece of something that he gathered, a little specimen of something, into an epoxy block so he can keep it there safely and have it there as a little paperweight there on his desk. And so I'm
standing neurotoxin there. Paperweight, okay.
Yes. Well, you know, it's a neurotoxin as it's still not cured.
Oh, okay.
When it's in liquid form, but once it cures, it's safe.
Oh, now I got you. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm
not no. It was well, the yeah. It was the plastic that was the neurotoxin.
Yeah. Okay. I'm distracted by the imagery I see in my mind right now. I'm really in there. I remember it so well. It was a really an exciting time, an exciting moment for me. So immediately I see this idea because my parents, we would go to the museum every weekend. They would ask me, so what do you want to do this weekend? You know, what are we going to do all together now that you're home from school this weekend? And I would always want to go down to the museums and every weekend there was not a single weekend where I'd say, oh, you know what? We go to the museums too much. Let's do something else. It was always, I just wanted to go down there and look around at all the amazing things. And my father would point at things saying, oh, that'd be really neat. And isn't that inspiring? And it'd be great to have something like that. And so many people's houses would benefit so much and children would just love to have things like this, that kind of stuff. So, so then I just thought to myself right there, I thought this would be a great gift to make something like my father's making with all kinds of really rare things. It would make a great gift for my father and make it just something that I think a lot of people could really, really like. That's where it came from.
So like a 40-year idea that came into fruition.
Now, it takes me a little bit to get things done sometimes.
Now I understand it was, like, take me back to, and again, to my research, early 2014, before this actually came into fruition. What was the, what got you to actually do it?
Okay, well, yeah, I was also going to add, not only does it take me a long time to get things done, but I can't do things on my own. I really enjoy it. Not only do I enjoy working with people, but I need to. And, I was working, doing my dream job of designing products, making toys.
Right. You were with Think Geek, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. Cool. That's right. I'm fortunate enough right now. Everyone here at my office, we all work together at Think Geek, actually, so it's really wonderful to be still working together.
Yeah.
So I was making the custom products there as their first custom product designer. And then a great time, but laid off and then one of the co-founders of Think Geek, Willie Vadnais, and a lot of people there, Jamie Grove, who was the head of marketing there, and a lot of people there wanted to help me too. They knew I was really down and also. My skills are very specialized, and I was very fortunate to find work like that there. So, you know, I'm behind on house payments, and things were very tough. In fact, that's actually where the beard came from. Was I had never had a beard. I'd never not shaved for, I think, more than maybe 2 days maximum. and so the beard started and all kinds of things. And it wasn't even, I didn't even know that people were having beards. I didn't know that, you know, I think that was coming about at that time.
It's the beard renaissance.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And I had no idea. So when I did that video, I don't watch TV. I've never owned a TV. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that people actually had beards. So I thought I probably looked totally insane, but I had no idea it actually fit in a little bit.
Yeah.
The people I'm working with now, most of them already then came to my rescue, really. And I remember Willie saying, looking at me and looking at my financial situation and saying, wow, Hans, I know you needed help. I didn't know you needed this bad. Anyway, they got together really quickly and we all worked very hard together. And yeah, so we got together and it was really me, Willie, and Jamie working every single day, on this. To get the first one done.
Yeah. And
a lot of other people helping out. Actually, it wasn't just them. It was a lot of people I knew. Pretty much every person, every friend I had really helped me out enormously, including my brother, my sister. I mean, everybody. Without pr- pretty much without every single friend I had, I don't know if it could have gotten done. But
so that's, I mean, the human side of that is amazing too, because, you know, again, these little pieces, these mini museums are fascinating. They spawn the imagination and the desire to learn. But now that I hear that, there's also a bit of, your personal, I guess, drive and ambition that went into it alone. And the story of everyone coming together. I mean, so my dad told me, if you're going, I said, and I don't remember how old I was, but I remember, I guess, asking him what it meant to be a good person. Like, how do you become a good person? And my dad is, he's not very touchy-feely. He's not really, he's a carpenter, and he's the type that would, you know, cut, gash his finger on a table saw and then just wrap it up in duct tape and keep going. And he told me, he said, well, and I think I was young when he said this. He said, if when you die, a lot of people are standing around your grave saying, there goes a good man. And I was like, hey, you know, that's that, a simple thing like that has stuck with me for my life. So, and it sounds like, you know, not to get morbid, but if you were to die, a lot of people would be standing by your grave. I mean, it sounds like that you were really lucky to have all those friends.
Yeah. I'm very, very lucky. Yeah. I sometimes feel a little guilty. I feel like I'm, you know, I'm more lucky than they are. That's for sure. yeah, you're right. No, it's a very nice thing for your father to say that. It's,
Yeah.
So, although I hope they're not, I hope my friends don't, they got so many interesting things they can do. I hope they're not going to spend too much time around me.
Yeah.
When I'm not around.
I'm the type too. When I'm gone, I don't care. I want to put me on a boat and set me on fire like a, the Vikings. That'd be great for me. I don't party.
Yeah.
I don't really. So, another thing I want to talk about, which I think is really neat and it touches home personally for me, is the idea of, we address technology a lot on this podcast, and only because of what it's offering us and, where it's taking us as a people. Technology through Kickstarter, I think that's another big part of this, is that, you funded, I want to say a majority of it, I would assume, because, on the article it said you raised over $1 million this way, through Kickstarter. And tell me about that. What made you think to go that route? And was it good working with them?
When I first started thinking, and I mentioned something, I don't know how this came about, but I said to in one of the meetings there, one of the interview portions of the interview, I said, "Yeah, I don't actually have a television set." And Willie leans over to me and goes, "Yeah, don't mention that again." I didn't know exactly what Kickstarter was. I mean, I'd heard of it, and actually I didn't even realize that, I had seen it several times and thought, wow, that is so wonderful that somebody, I don't know, somewhere, and it was some child sitting there making a quick little videotape of themselves at some high school or university, and they had some nice idea, and they were able to raise money to get this idea done.
Yeah.
So I had heard a little bit about it, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So wonderful. I never thought of myself actually using it. I just thought it's such a great thing for people to be able to do that. And then a friend of mine, Jacob, who's now working with Etsy, but he was working at ThinkGeek as well at the time. And when I had left ThinkGeek, and he said, you should really take this mini museum idea and put it. Everybody kind of knew about the mini museum idea there. In fact, I think I was kind of hired because that was kind of a little bit of my, I think when I had first met Willie, he had heard of the, I mentioned the mini museum thing, and they'd want to buy it for ThinkGeek, but I just never got it made. And then instead they hired me to be at one of their, make their toys there. I kind of lost myself. Oh yeah. So Jacob said, you should do that. And then Jamie as well told me that I should do this and put it on Kickstarter. And I think a lot of people started telling me that, but they thought I was going to be able to do it on my own. And I am very much, I think the people didn't know me too well over there, because I kind of held, I think, myself at a distance a lot of time. And I think people didn't realize how there are certain things I can do very well and on my own. Mm-hmm. But such a project as this, and at the time when I just felt things were a little bit overwhelming for me.
Yeah.
So the Kickstarter really happened that we all decided that was the best thing to do. I mean, and they convinced me very easily. And we decided that's the route we're going to go. It's a very friendly route. I mean, yeah. The people at Kickstarter. Yeah, I mean, it's like when people, you can look at an organization and you think, wow, these people must be really wonderful. At this museum, they must really love all this stuff. And then when you meet them and you talk with the curators there or the people there who work at the museum, you find out, my gosh, they really love this stuff. And they're so welcoming. That's why they're showing all this stuff in this museum. And it's the same thing with Kickstarter. Kickstarter, these people who work at Kickstarter, they absolutely love helping people. They love ideas and they love new technologies and new ideas coming about. So they're extremely welcoming. I mean, not that I spoke with them personally, but the care package they give you when you want to start, I mean, the instructions they give you and how easy they make it. I mean, they're a bunch of really great, wonderful people. So and made it very easy.
And what's amazing about it is if you know, you were just, you know, born 20 years earlier, this would, you know, it may not have been come into fruition, this idea of yours. I mean, it could have, but it would have been a lot more, you know, pounded on doors and saying, hey, would you like to, you know, fund this? And the technology is just so great in assisting people to help launch their dreams. I think it's truly unique of the modern age. Never before, thanks to technology, has been an outlet for creativity. You know, I guess their downfall is it could flood the market with, you know, shitty things because if everyone's putting stuff out there, but they fail and that's okay. You know, most of it doesn't fail because even the most shitty concepts, there's someone that has a fan of it. I mean, it's this podcast is a perfect example. But it allows us to connect, and I think that's a great thing. I personally, I'm someone who I like tech. Actually, I love technology, and I understand there's also that you know, you can't let it get too involved in your life because we have to have that interpersonal communication with each other, but the assistance that it offers us and the stories like yours is just amazing, and I feel so lucky to be part of this generation, this age where we can do that. You can fund someone's short film from Bangladesh, you know, if you feel like doing it. I would never be able to do that 20 years ago.
Yes No, absolutely. No, the people who had funded my Kickstarter, so many of them had funded so many other people before that and made so many great projects and products come about. It feels great to just give somebody just $5 or $10, even if one's not interested in the product itself that they're going to make, just to kind of help them a little bit. And everything does. I mean, some people would just send $1 or $5, and I was so grateful. You know, it's such a great thing. They actually took their time.
Yeah.
And I mean, they gave me their money, and they're saying, hey, I like your project, and yeah, sure, I don't want to buy it necessarily, or I don't have the money to buy it, or this that, but I really like what you're doing, and please take this and do something with it.
That's really cool. That's really, it's just, you know, and it's, you know, a cup of coffee or something like that. You're making a small sacrifice to help someone out, man.
And the time it took them to do that too, they actually had to take that time to make sure that cup of coffee came to me. And you know, at that time, damn, any little cup of coffee really helped me. Actually, I'm not a coffee drinker, but what I mean, even, you know, a cup of, a cup of tea. I mean, really, at that time, I was in such bad shape, and a lot of people when they're doing the Kickstarters are lot of these people. They had the video, they look really happy, everything looks really great, and they are, everything is great, and they are really happy, and because they're having a chance to do something that they love doing. But really, behind the scenes, they're in dire straits, and they because they put a lot of time and effort into and a lot of eggs in this basket to hopefully have this work.
Yeah,
and you know, if this had failed, I would have been very relieved in a lot of, either way, it can be a relief. I mean, sure, there can be it can be very sad to fail at something. But at least I would have known. I would have thought, oh, okay, well, people aren't that interested in this, and I can get over this now. I'll try something else. Or I would talk with people, and I'd find out, okay, I guess I should just like a lot of people, when they put a product together, they might have a very good idea, but maybe their video is not good enough, or they're not really expressing it. I think everything, by the way, everything needs a video, just pretty much everything. Like it's hard to sell an idea or something without having a video. Doesn't even have to be a great video, but if you can just show what you're doing, what you want to make, give people a good idea of what it is, and if you can be on that video, that would be really great. But at the very least, to show people a prototype or something.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people fail with that, because they don't show a prototype. They don't show a version of what people are going to be getting, and they don't do a video.
I think one of the interesting things that you said too is the failing part is okay, and I think a lot of people, they're afraid to fail, or they think it's not okay to fail. Failing is part of life, you know. It's what makes you succeed. In fact, there had to have been some failures in you setting this up, right? You had little failures, little successes, and eventually you came up with your prototype, and people are buying it up. So, and I think it's, I don't know if it's a generational thing. People just don't want to fail, or they feel like it's a negative thing, but no, failing is part of the battle. Failing is what makes us good. You know, it's what gives us drive.
Yeah, if I was less afraid of failure, I would have gotten a lot further in my life by now, I'm sure. And that goes with pretty much anybody who's that afraid of failure. They might not be able to do as many things in their life, and they might not, again, serendipity, there might not be so many chances for that serendipity.
But is there any better feeling than stepping off that ledge? You know, when you finally, you don't know how it's going to go. Personally, I think it's a great feeling. I don't know if you had the same, response, but, you know, just looking back on the risks that I took in my life, I really, really enjoy that stepping off, that going, all right, I'm making the move, and not knowing what's going to come out on the other side.
Well, I completely agree, but my risks have been so much less than yours. You have taken really hardcore, huge risks. No, I mean that. I mean, I'm not, but of course I mean that. You have taken big risks. You've taken big risks to do things that are really important for people. I haven't taken such risks. So stepping off of the platform I stepped off of, yes, it felt really great, and it feels really amazing. And I don't remember that it's not like I'm ever trying to do that. I'm never trying to go there again or anything like that. I don't even realize it. It's a surprise to me every single time when I get to it. I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's right. Here's this ledge, and it's an amazing thing to step off of.
Yeah.
But you, yeah, that's probably the ledges you've stepped off of are much more exhilarating than the ones that
I attribute
that
to not being old and wise. I was in my young invincible stage, and I can't remember who I had on. Gosh, maybe it was James Barrett. He's an author of what's his book? Artificial Intelligence, Our Final Invention. And
Yes.
I think it was him. We were talking about how just naturally being a young man, it's amazing. If you make it, you know, to be a middle-aged guy, you've already done a lot of good. You've survived a lot of bad choices.
Right. Yes.
So.
Yes, that's very true.
What else? Oh, there was another thing. I also am a owner of one of my favorite pieces is the piece of chainmail and the Neanderthal hand axe. Those were my Father's Day gifts this year. Which is different
those
than the mini
amazing.
Museum, but you actually sold these pieces that you can hold and touch, and that alone brings a whole. To use completely improper English, a whole nother aspect to holding on to a piece of history.
Yes.
So the chainmail is obviously, if listeners don't know, it's you see the knights and they wear that kind of, I don't know what you would call it, like a tunic that's made out of links of metal.
That's perfectly said. Yeah.
And you got now. Oh, do you know what? Actually, I want to back up a little bit further because this is a question I had. getting these pieces, how difficult was it? Was it an adventure in and of itself to get some of these things, like sand from Dracula's castle? I mean, tell me about that process.
Yeah, that sand actually. Okay, well, let's see. Yes, it's difficult. No, it's not difficult.
Okay,
one pretty much finds out who you go to a museum. Now, there's many ways of doing this, but this is an example. This is just one example. Go to a museum. You see your favorite dinosaur there, and you think, "Wow, I sure would love to have a piece of real piece of Brontosaurus." Now you can, you can go places and they might have a generic dinosaur bone. It's a chunk of a bone. It's not known what dinosaur that is. Someday, probably one can point one's telephone at it and it'll take some sort of a little survey with this spectral analysis and the color reflections coming off of it can tell the camera, tell the software to check up the online data bank of what kind of a spectrum this is, and then you find out, oh, okay, this is actually this kind of dinosaur bone. So this kind of stuff, I'm sure, will come about just like now one's taking hand axes and sending those to a laboratory, and they take out minute traces of different types of meat, different types of things that hand axe has chopped away at. So you go to a museum, you look at your favorite dinosaur, you write to the curator and say, "Where'd you get that dinosaur bone? Where'd you get the dinosaur, that full skeleton there?" Mm-hmm. And then they write back and they say, "Oh, it's from so-and-so who dug this up in the 1800s. Okay, well, back to square one then. But eventually you find some museum or some place or some new exhibit or in a magazine where somebody's dug up some dinosaur bone and that dinosaur is going to now go to some museum. Then you contact that person. Mm-hmm. Okay, they themselves might not offer to give or sell any dinosaur bones, but they might have a friend who does dig for dinosaur bones, or they might have a contact somewhere of somebody, or they might say, "Well, I do work with some people who also have pieces of this same dinosaur or the one that was laying right next to it, and they are selling that dinosaur." Okay, so you contact them. All right, well, they only want to sell the whole skeleton. It's $3 million.
Yeah.
Okay, but they have scraps. Okay. They have scraps from that same another dinosaur that was laying right next to that one, or they have scraps from that dinosaur because in making the armature and putting these dinosaur bones together, there were certain scraps that fell off that they decided they were just going to simply putty that part back up.
Okay.
And so they have actual scraps from that actual dinosaur that's actually in that museum.
Cool.
And you're getting this from then, you know, the top professionals who dug it out themselves. That's one way of getting the real thing and from a great source.
Okay.
That's one way of doing it.
So you got to do some sleuthing. You got to do almost like a journalistic type of approach. A lot of research,
yes.
A lot of talking.
Yes. Yes. But you see, it's not that difficult. And at the end of it all, the people who come over to your house and they see this dinosaur bone that you have there and you can say this story, it's actually great for them to see this and know, wow, this is really a real piece of that. For you, in a way, the adventure, the meeting these different people and the people you talk with and hearing their also little side stories of how they got something or how they got these things, or like when you just said what your father said about how having people around as standing around your grave means that you were a good person. You know, it's those kinds of things that end up being the best part of it. But the Dracula soil, that actually, so there's two interesting sides to that. One is how I got it. The other is what an interesting lesson that I learned that then it's actually a very peculiar one. So that one, there is plenty of sources I found by contacting different people to get soil from. Are you all right there?
Yeah. It's my hand axe box just fell over, but we're good to go.
it's haunting us. So what happened was I finally decided, okay, basically I can get this stuff and it's real, but I have so many shades of it now, different colors of it. It looks so very different. I'm thinking, okay, that's probably because it's different seasons. Finally, I just thought, oh man, I will not, this is such a simple one, but I'm not going to be comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very hard to, you can't fake a whole dinosaur bone laying in the ground, although there are a lot of people who think that they are fake, but you know, things like that are hard to, it's a real dinosaur. It's really laying there. It's really the bones. It's laying down in the ground. It's got the skull, the whole vertebra, yeah. Everything's right there.
Yeah.
But this one just drove, it was one of the many things that drive me crazy where I'm finally thinking, okay, forget it. I'm just going to go and get it myself. So I go there to Romania, and funny enough, I actually meet people there. Well, I met one guy there who went to, well, I met some people there, but this one guy I spent more time with there because we both drove back to the airport from Vlad the Impaler's castle. And he told me this story about how he had gone to different places in Romania trying to find the real Vlad the Impaler's castle. And there are several castles there that okay. that they talk about that Vlad the Impaler has been to.
Okay.
Vlad Tempus is the kind of the inspiration for Dracula,
yeah,
for Bram
right.
Stoker, Dracula. So and there's fantastic stories I would love to mention about what Vlad the Impaler did and how that castle was built. It was basically, I just don't want to spend too much time on this, but it was been built by children who were invited to for a party. And it turned out after the party was over and these children were treated so beautifully to this dinner, he kept the children there, made them build this castle on top of the ruins of a previous castle, and didn't let them go home. Just they had to finish this castle. So at the end of it, the children who were left over hadn't died. They were free to go home. When they came home, they found that their parents had been murdered that night that they were having their dinner. Then also the wife of Vlad the Impaler had apparently jumped off through their bedroom window screaming, "I'd rather die and rot in the river than be captured by the Turks." So I'm there. When I get there, it's all dark. It's midnight. It's just about midnight.
That's perfect.
And you're right. I thought so too, but I couldn't see the castle. And they said, "Oh, the lights have been turned off tonight." I don't even, usually lights are on, but they just decided to turn them off this night. Okay. So the lights are off. I'm looking up at this mountain ridge and I can't see the shadow or anything of this castle. And I basically gave myself enough time to get there, get the soil and get out. So I'm looking up there and thinking, gee, how am I going to do this one? And I was warned that there's wolves, there's packs of dogs and there's bears there.
Vampires.
And then, right. Everything but vampires. Yeah. Actually, there were a phenomenal amount of bats all throughout Romania.
Okay.
So I thought, okay, well, at first I believed them, but I realized this is a gimmick. I'm sure they're just saying this because it sounds exciting and thrilling. So I go to my room, get my gear, and which is basically just a backpack and a bunch of plastic bags. And then I look at I look in the guidebook, which I hadn't done before. I figure, okay, I'm gonna look in the guidebook just to see what's going on with this area here right now. And it did say, in fact, this area here. Well, a lot of Romania is the most densely packed area of wolves, bears, and wild and packs of dogs. So I thought, okay, in order to avoid being harmed by these creatures, I'm going to look for that river, and I'm going to climb that cliff rather than walk up the mountain. I'm climbing the cliff to their bedroom window. So I did, and in doing this, when I'm getting very close up, I heard talking, and I thought, okay, it sounds like there's an older man and about two younger people, and they're teenagers or 20s, and they're right up there. I'm thinking, geez, if I surprise them, this isn't maybe going to be so good. I don't know how I'm going to exactly do this. I'm going to look completely crazy the way I'm climbing up the side of this yeah. mountain. And also the climb was really bad. Things were crumbling under my hands. I'm not a great free climber, but I enjoy free climbing.
I'm picturing Bram Stoker's Dracula. If you don't have a TV, you probably have never seen it, but this sounds exactly like the movie where he's crawling out on the side in between two windows of the castle. And
yeah, right.
Okay.
I have seen that movie.
Oh, okay.
And
there you go.
And my gosh, it was such a weird movie too, because it's like, I don't know if you felt this, but I felt like I'm watching a movie with a bunch of actors and then Gary Oldman is a vampire.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like it's a real vampire in this movie. It was so bizarre.
Yeah, that's funny.
So I get up there and there are no people there. And I had really heard this conversation. I don't believe in ghosts, and I never have.
Yeah.
And I never did. And I didn't after that. But it bothered me so much. That climb and hearing conversations that I could almost make out drove me absolutely crazy. But and I didn't want to tell hardly anybody. I felt I had to tell. I told some of my closest friends because I was really jarred after this.
Yeah.
But and then only recently, when I've tracked down another item that I'm hoping to put in Mini Museum 3. If not, it'll have to wait till Mini Museum 4. But I was talking with somebody who explained to me he studies this phenomenon, which I had just solved 2 days previously, and which is my neighbor moved. I got his aquarium. I'm now in the kitchen cooking some food, mm-hmm. and I hear a conversation coming from my living room, and I'm thinking, what? There's no one in my living room, and my dogs are sitting perfectly calm. So I know nobody has made it into my house, but there's a conversation going on in my living room. I go around the corner into my living room, and it's the bubbling of the aquarium.
Oh.
Four times in my life, there are sounds that I will hear. And and when I climbed to the top of that mountain, that wind was so harsh. Mm-hmm. And also, there was I didn't even mention, it was raining like crazy. A big storm came right over the lip of the mountain and just rained. It went from beautiful night sky to crazy rain in just a few seconds. So apparently, it's happened to me about four times in my life that I've heard conversations, and then there's no one there. And it's coming from wind, or in this case, the aquarium, the bubbles. I just hear things that aren't there. Yeah, it bothers me so much that I could ever imagine that when I'm such a, I feel I'm such a realist, and you know, you'll be walking somewhere and you'll look down the ground and you'll say, somebody will say, "Oh my gosh, is that a mouse?" And you look over and you'll be like, no, it's like this exact, it's like a crinkled piece of wrapping from a Wrigley's spearmint gum thing. And they're like, no, it's not. It's a mouse. And you look closer and it is it's a Wrigley's spearmint gum crumpled up there or something like that. You know, I don't see things and make things up in my head what they are, but apparently it's happened to me about four times where I hear a conversation, it's not there.
Well, after that story, now I want to invite you on around Halloween to talk about Vlad the Impaler. I think that'd be a great show. Because I'm going to be honest with you, I don't know anyone that's been around that area. So I'm going to definitely extend that invite to you. I think that'd be fun.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah. I'd love to. I'll make it as creepy as possible, which is basically just tell the real stories.
All right, that's great. So just gathering these pieces then, in some cases, it sounds like it was an adventure, obviously, in and of itself.
Yes. Again, very fun, nerve-wracking and exciting. Yeah.
To go back to the hand axe and the... So I got the hand axe and I got the piece of chainmail. And mm-hmm. and there's times where I just like to hold it in my hand. And I don't know... It's hard for me to kind of... to put words into the experience you have with old items. You know, I'll go to a history museum here in North Carolina and I'm looking at, oh, here's a perfect example. We were in South Carolina and there was a, we went to some museum and they had a lock of Robert E. Lee's hair.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And, you know, not that I'm a fan of the Confederate States or anything like that.
No.
But to have, you know, an individual in history, again, history is, for all intents and purposes, it's a story. I mean, it's something that we just have to say, okay, you know, legitimately people wrote this down and, you know, it's how things went, but it's still a story to us because we don't have any sort of connection. And to stand there, I remember staring at this hair, looking really, really close and just realizing that this sprouted from the head of one of the all-time historical figures of the mid, what is that, the 17th century? Is it one ahead? So that would be the 19th century. I have trouble putting it into words, what it does and how it kind of conjures up the imagination and puts a tangible experience with something that is otherwise intangible.
Yes.
I guess you could look at it, like this. Tell me if I'm going just way off into the weeds here and then you can rein me back in. But time is like a snake, right? It moves along. So to I guess clarify that, if if we were living in a two-dimensional world, okay, and you wanted to look at a balloon, you wouldn't be able to see the balloon. It would pass in front of you in segments, and it would look first like a little circle, and then it would get larger and larger and larger, and then it would go back down to a little circle. We'd have no way to understand that the balloon that just passed in front of you actually has, you know, it's more than just that circle. It's a three-dimensional thing.
It's a beautiful visual, yes.
And
yes.
Time is just like that. Every fragment of time has a version of us, has a version of me and you.
Yes.
And we are only allowed to see a momentary fragment, a little unit of that, which, you know, we really don't even know what it is. We can't say exactly, you know, what that moment is, but as soon as it's there, it's gone. There's no going further and there's no going back. But when you take something like that, let's just talk about the piece of chainmail.
Yes.
You know, humans and or all living things, we have to coexist to experience each other, right? We have to, like, you know, or the mammoth, we have to exist at the same time. Otherwise, the moments, they don't overlap. You know, there's no connection between us and the past. But yes. Inanimate objects don't have to coexist, you know. They persist beyond, you know, our lifetimes and any animal's lifetimes. Mm. So these little pieces of history are tangible connections to our past, meaning like a silent time machine. You know, it reaches past, it reaches beyond that linear movement of time, and it says, you know, you know that whoever owned that chainmail, which maybe you know or don't know, now he and I or she and I have a connection that. Otherwise would never be able to be experienced. Or like the insect and the amber, same thing. I mean, it's there. It's there to see, and it's like a time machine. It connects you to that past that is no longer part of our current moments. It's really an amazing and awe-inspiring feeling to hold it in your hands. Did I just go into what do we call that, pot talk?
No, I really liked everything you said. No, I agree. You know, there's it's kind of like that. Never in the same river twice. I think also another. I really like your two-dimensional imagery that you put there. There's a way. I also like looking at these things is that if. And I've seen this written in one book, and I think it was Neil Shabin's "Your Inner Fish" or something. It's something that I've thought of from since I was a child. If one could see everyone we know standing, if time would suddenly stop, or we could see everybody. How would I say this? If behind each person, if it were standing in a queue in a long line, mm-hmm. and behind your friend, you'd see his or her parents, and then behind them theirs, and so on. And you just keep walking down this line, and it keeps breaking apart in different trees. And you could just follow these people, the your friend's mother, and then your friend's mother's parents, and then that splits up, and all these people keep splitting up, and all the people came before them are just standing right behind them. Mm-hmm. And you could keep following them back, and you walk back a mile or two behind these people, and people are really looking different. And 3 or 5, 10 miles or 100 miles down the way, and now you're standing next to people that are now barely walking and much hairier.
Yeah, yeah.
And eventually to walk all the way back to see the first little things and how they got there to evolve to be us.
Mm-hmm.
To look at these things that one's holding, and these people will never be able to see us, and we'll never be able to see them eye to eye.
Right.
These creatures or these people that own these things before us, we'll never be able to really see that Neanderthal sitting there, or that person sitting there, a kind of a person, a proto, you know, that being sitting there, clicking away at that stone, and what they're clicking away at that stone for, and what's happening around them, what will happen with them, what happened to them in the past, and it is amazing. Each one of these little pieces really are forever inspiring. Really,
yeah. They really are, and I'm glad you did it. I'm glad you put together this thing because it's just a really, really cool thing. And for folks who are interested, they can go to, what's the website they can check it out?
Yeah, it's just minimuseum.com, and we're going to be, there's the second mini museum that's on there right now for sale. It's a large version and a smaller version with a few less specimens in it, and then we'll be introducing the third one in within a few months.
Right. And yeah. And I think, you know, just you telling your story has put a little more, so it puts, I don't want to say value, but you know, you're not just, when you buy something like this, you're not just getting a little trinket to be like, hey, look at my dinosaur poop. I mean, there's a story behind it. There's a human part of it. There's your story. There's the stories of, you know, I mean, there's a piece of human skull in here. Looking at this little piece of human skull, that person had birthdays. That person had good days. That person had bad days. Their whole life is right there now, you know, on your desk or wherever you choose to. Oh, actually, there's even a human brain, you know. It's something that is really just it's a unique thing to have. And you know, if I wanted to go out and collect these things on my own, I wouldn't even know where to begin, and to have these all together in one spot is just a really cool thing. And my kids love it. And I always joke when my father-in-law comes to town, I was like, hey, I said, you want to, you know, you can pay a lifetime membership, $5, and you can go to the museum anytime you want, or it's 50 cents for every trip you take through my mini museum. it's really, really a cool thing. And I encourage the listeners to check it out, because I can't say more glowing things about it. It's really, really cool. And I'm glad to actually own one.
Thanks, Kevin. Thank you. It's very, very nice of you to say that. I wish, you know, it's after hours here in my office. Jamie and Willie and Jen and Bill and Andrea and Stephanie and Grant and their little child they're expecting in Stephanie's tummy right now, and Max, who just left to go to college. They're not here to be able to say thank you also, but I know they would. We work tirelessly at this.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I mean it about the Vlad the Impaler. I'm going to have you on again.
I mean it too. I'm ready.
I think it'd be cool. Do some research. I'll do a little research on my end, and we'll chat about that. I think it'd be really cool.
Yeah. No, there's some other creepy things and creepy people and creepy creatures and creepy plants also to mention in that case for a Halloween episode. There's There's a lot to explore there. I've also even wanted to make a Halloween edition mini museum, because
that'd be cool.
We do have, I mean, you have in yours, I guess you have already the mummy wrap in the
first too.
One. So there's a lot of things I think one equates with Halloween. Well, I'm excited about it. I'm ready.
Yeah, that's really cool. Oh, the one thing I couldn't figure out, like, people look at it and myself, they see Corinthian leather and they're like, whoa, what's Corinthian leather? And I'm like, it's just the seat from a Cadillac or I don't
remember. Cordoba.
Cordoba. Okay. Yeah. What's that doing in there?
The mini museums are it's kind of like a, I don't know, for me, really, when I make it, there's a lot of mantras I have in my mind, and there's a lot of things I want to kind of, a lot of thoughts I want to maybe try to evoke or places I want to go. And that really is a really trivial piece in a lot of ways. And a lot of people were very upset that I put it in there, and I completely understand. And I understand, you know, there are pieces in the mini museum I'm upset I put in there, and I wouldn't have it any other way though. And it's the way I want it to be, and had the feeling I want to give, and it's supposed to be irritating. It's supposed to be annoying. And the reason it is because, yeah, it's something that was mentioned on the commercial. These people, the advertisers, that's one of the reasons I don't have a television set. I really, when I would see advertisements as a kid where they would say, hey kids, you got to have this toy. This is really great. Uh-huh. Like, okay, I don't want that toy. I don't care how great that toy is. I don't want that toy now, because they might be trying to fool me into feeling like I'm going to have a bunch of friends if I buy this toy or whatever. And it just bothers me, because the toy looks great. It looks really interesting. I really want to see it. But now I'm bothered by, oh, I buy this toy and I have instant friends and things like that. It's manipulation. Mm-hmm. And the Corinthian leather was, it sounds exotic. It's cows from New Jersey, and and it's put into the Chrysler Cordoba, and they just decide to make it sound really special. But the name is invented, and it's it's just simply regular. Actually, the seat is leather, and I think some of it's plastic. It's got it's nice leather. It's not bad or anything like that. It's but it's a gimmick, and that's for me a very important thing to remember to realize all the time is that one is going to be manipulated in life, and one should be careful and not buy into that kind of stuff. And so that's what it is. And it is annoying, but it's annoying in other ways that maybe a lot of people maybe kind of overlooked. And it seems so trivial, but I didn't know what else to put in there. And I just wanted, and it was something that stuck in my mind for years and years and years, ever since I first saw the advertisements when I was a kid.
Well, it's definitely a conversation starter. I mean,
I'm sorry to everybody who's upset with it. I still don't know what I would put in its place, and I wanted that kind of a thing.
Yeah, no, I'm not upset. Now I know the story behind it. And it makes sense when you read about it, you know, in the booklet, you kind of get an idea. But when I first saw it, I was like, what is it? I don't, because I'm 39, so I think I was a little bit too
old
to remember that.
You're right. But, yes, I'm 47 as of 2 days ago.
So, oh,
yes.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
So do you have a Twitter? It sounds like you're kind of off the grid sort of, but, is really the best place for people to get a hold of you on, to catch up on what you guys are up to and what things you're putting together is just through that website, minimuseum.com.
Yes. To do that, to sign up to a mailing list, we send out all kinds of little information and updates of what we're doing, and it's illustrated. It talks about our processes of one learns how to make little things or do little things or little parts about history that have just been released or not even yet, but will be released in scientific journals and so on. So we really do as much hunting for the newest information on these things whether the scientists have yet released their reports or whether they're very new. And then we send that out, and we never, ever, ever sell or give away any. The only thing that we use the people's emails for is for what they asked for, which is to be informed about the mini museum. That's it.
Yeah.
So yeah, they can sign up.
Do you give any tours of your offices?
Well, yeah, we get a lot of people who want to come over and visit. It's not a storefront or anything like that. It's really us seven people who are introverted and awkward in many ways. But if you're introverted and you're awkward, then we probably will all get along really well. So people do ask us sometimes if they can come over and have a little tour, and we're pretty busy here, but you know, we always field the emails, and if somebody really wants to come in there's something, it will help them out in some way, or if they have some questions about how to do a Kickstarter, or they have some I don't know, they have some questions, absolutely, we're always open to that kind of stuff.
All right, fantastic.
Yeah, that's what we do, this stuff, because we like all this kind of stuff. It's just that we're so busy and we're so behind right now and stuff like that, but we do love to explain these things and give people tours and talk about. So we do have people come in. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you, for sharing your story with me. I'll contact you around Halloween. We'll have some, we'll have a good conversation. I think that'll be fun.
That'd be great. I'll be eating Reese's peanut butter cups and gummy bears and listening to and telling all kinds of creepy things.
All right.
Thank you very, very much, Kevin. Okay. I very much look forward to it. Thanks for this great evening.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you, Hans.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast. And at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.